It's the Ag Watcher Show. It's the Ag Watcher Show. It's the Ag Watcher Show.
I'm Robert Hewitt. I've been working across the pork production supply chain for the last 25 years and arguing with anyone who's wrong in the internet for about just as long.
We came across you on Twitter. You're a meat evangelist on Twitter, aren't you? So not to be confused with Meat Watcher, of course.
Yeah, I picked up that handle when I started Twitter a long time ago, and it flows out of work that I used, time that I used to spend on a ABC-based forum, which was Dr. Carl's forums, on science-based forums, which was, a long time ago. So, I've been arguing for about 25 years, I reckon.
But you're good at it. You're very objective in your arguing.
Yeah, so. it's my nature and my personality. You've done any of those personality tests and, I'm a pretty upstream, objective, data-based, evidence-based person.
Nothing like us.
I was actually thinking there, like we've been connected for a long time and I've enjoyed your conversations online, but I never actually saw what you look like until now.
So it's
quite interesting that you can speak to someone and not know what they look like for a long time.
Yeah, it's one of those things. I've never had my face up on things, and I've always worked in the background and generally don't like putting my face up on things, but you do from time to time.
Another thing you've got in common with Matt and I. So there we go.
Mm. Yeah, we like to stay in the shadows, don't we?
Stay in the background.
Yeah.
So we've got to do the Sixth Sense. We've got to run that through you. I know you've listened to the podcast a lot, so we probably don't need to give you the instructions. But for any new listeners, we'll be asking Robert or giving Robert six phrases or words, and we will be expecting back a short response back on his views.
Mm.
Some might call it word association, but I call it AI integrated psychological testing.
Regenerative
and organic.
Yep.
Let's go, Matt.
Pork sector efficiency.
Number one. Well, compared with chicken, but vitally important for the Australian pig industry to continue being efficient.
Black pudding.
A non-believer.
Oh, dear me. How can you work in the pork sector and not be into
Matt, we'll get on to that.
I'll give you a second opportunity to redeem yourself. Haggis.
Haggis. I have tried. Yeah, I think there's a lot nicer bits of animals than offal.
Okay, fair enough. Animal rights activists.
A pain, but quite a good wake-up call for industries.
Live export of whether it's cattle or sheep.
Potential risk to industry.
Animal welfare in Australia.
Generally very good. We can always make improvements though.
Right.
There you go. Easy. Lots to talk about there. Well, do you want to give it before, because you mentioned quickly who you were in terms of your name and that, but what's your actual background and kind of what did you study? What do you do for an actual living?
Yep. So I grew up on a small little farm, but not farmers, not far from you guys in Scottsburn. The now infamous Scottsburn after the last few things in Ballarat.
It's been a bit, was it you, Andrew, that told me or someone? I know, I was speaking to someone yesterday.
16% of all women murdered in 2024 have been in Ballarat.
From the Ballarat region. Well, the most recent one was just literally around the corner from where I am in Scarsdale, which is where the remains were found, which is just pretty disturbing stuff. But okay. So you're roughly a local then originally.
Yeah. So I went to the dodgy school, the dodgy Catholic school in Ballarat, And then headed down to uni in Melbourne. So I've got an agricultural science degree.
And
one of the few people that have ever majored in intensive animal production. And then ended up, starting my career with, well, the group that's now Sunpork.
Mm-hmm.
Started working on an outdoor pig farm between Werribee and Bacchus Marsh. Progressing through that. So progressing through nucleus herds and then moving into technical and research roles. And I've been operating in that space for probably the last 15 years.
So Matt and I used to own a pig farm up at Bridgewater near, mm-hmm.
yep.
near Bendigo. One of the things that fascinated, like, we didn't have any background in intensive agriculture. To be honest, we didn't have any background in agriculture in general before we took it on.
It was a passive investment, Andrew, don't you remember?
Yeah, we were told when we bought it was a passive investment, which suddenly...
Yes, lots of those.
Yeah, we got sucked into that one pretty quickly, didn't we?
Yeah. So anyway, we shouldn't talk about that. But one of the things that fascinates me is just how efficient pork production is.
Yeah.
You know, how quickly it can go from a piglet to fully ready to slaughter or process, sorry, we're supposed to say process, not slaughter anymore, but ready to process animal in what, like 3 months, 4 months. What do you think about, you know, the actual sort of refinement of the pork industry over the past, in your time especially, there's been a huge increase in productivity. What's been the driver of that?
The primary driver has been genetics based. And the breeding companies have done a really good job in efficiency in Australia. And some of that is a bit more our specific market here. So we have a skin on market for mm-hmm. for most of our pork cuts. And so there's a need to reduce that back fat level to meet the supermarkets, which are the big drivers, really the supermarket's idea of what is the ideal bit of pork. And so if you can reduce fat deposition down, then that's really one driver of efficiency. So yeah, so there's a big focus on feed efficiency because every time you talk about grain prices being good for farmers or good for grain producers, I look at it the other way and go, yeah, that's a money directly on our bottom line because like feed costs are 65% of our feed costs kind of thing.
Yep.
So yeah, feed efficiency has been a really big driver on that, and you cope that with leanness and those kinds of things. So yeah, we've got probably some of the most feed efficient herds in the world in Australia,
mm-hmm.
That's been good and bad. But yeah, we're still trying to catch chicken. I don't think we ever will.
No.
But the feed efficiency is a really big driver of where we're trying to get to and where we're trying to turn that genetic improvement into dollars.
So going back to just while we're on the topic of genetic improvement, do you remember a couple of years ago in Western Australia there was
the shampoo bottles?
for those who weren't in the pig industry or aren't in the pig industry, a couple of years ago there was two people arrested, or was it one person arrested?
I think it was two.
It was two.
For illegally smuggling in pig semen from Denmark or Norway or somewhere.
Yeah, Denmark.
In shampoo bottles, which I'm surprised no ABC correspondent, when they were reporting that story, put up a picture of that scene from Something About Mary. But it's, did that, somebody told me, this is anecdotal, somebody told me that that was happening for a while and that it opened up genetics and improved genetics around the country because of that import. Is that true or is that just bunkum?
I think there's probably a bit of license with that.
Yeah.
I'm not fully aware of all the details of cases and stuff, but I think there were, it was more than just one importation that occurred, as far as I'm aware. And As to how far that has spread throughout the industry, I think it's pretty limited.
Okay.
And there are other aspects which probably haven't seen that. Won't see that. The reason they imported from Denmark was litter size. So the Danes have a significantly higher litter size than what we do. Litter size,
yeah, yep.
Yeah. And there are other limitations on us, which are probably not going to see that litter size realised into extra pigs being sold in the market.
Why was it illegal, though, to import it? Is it why
illegal?
Why is the restriction on it? Is it a biosecurity risk?
It's biosecurity and disease risk.
Hmm.
So, yeah, there are – Australia is, yeah, remarkably clean of pig diseases.
Yeah.
Yeah, we still have our health challenges, but when you talk to overseas people, they go, they even really diseases? Yeah. but, yeah, it's a disease risk. And so, if we ever export semen out, the number of tests that we need to get done, which we can only get done at the animal health labs down in Geelong because they're the only people that touch those kinds of things, is quite a long list.
Are there legitimate ways to? Could they have brought it in on a kind of authorized pathway, or it's just not a? It's too tricky, or don't. So you can't. No, you can't so do we, it at all, right?
No, so we had. There's no import risk assessment for pig semen or embryos or anything else like that, and that's an industry stance, because. If you look at New Zealand, for example, so New Zealand were allowing semen imports, and then when it came to people wanting to import fresh meat, then, it was a bit harder for them to combat that when you're allowing semen in, which is a risk.
That means that the Australian pork herd is pretty much a closed kind of, like all you can do is what you've got within the genetic stock currently, right? You can't bring in anything new.
Yeah, so, well, nothing can be brought in from outside of Australia.
Mm.
There are various breeding companies and studs around the place. But it's all part of the management of your genetic herds.
We met one of the breeders, didn't we? He's a Scottish guy.
Mm.
John?
There's a few of them.
He was
Beavers? Down, Beavers?
John Beavers.
Yeah.
Think
John, my first boss.
Yeah, it's because he was down that neck of the woods in between Werribee and Bacchus Marsh, wasn't he?
Yes. Yeah.
Interesting chap. So
yes.
from Edinburgh.
You mentioned about the feed efficiency aspects, you know, and more broader efficiencies that the pigs have vis-a-vis with chickens, and chickens being a bit more efficient again, and you know, conversion of food intake to meat. What's been? Do you know the approximate numbers of how efficient has the pig side become over the time you've been involved in it in terms of getting those levels? Because I mean, the pig already in its own natural state, for want of a better description, it's already a pretty efficient animal as it is, like a chicken. And obviously, lots of different animal sectors are trying all the time to get that efficiency, that feed conversion efficiency higher and higher. Do you know what the general trend is for pigs versus chickens versus others?
I couldn't tell you a trend, but yeah, when we're looking at, yeah, in a progeny herd, you're looking at, 2.3, some herds being lower than that, but that's sort of 2.25, 2.3 is a fairly good mark from, and that's a live weight feed efficiency. The chicken guys are well under 2. It's been...
So is that the volume of food to make 1 kilo of meat, is that right?
Yeah, so... Yeah. So yeah,
or
so
1 kilo of live weight, yeah?
Yeah, so feed conversion ratio, you can measure it a few different ways, but, yeah, we talk about, a kilogram of feed for a kilogram of live weight is the, mm-hmm. it's the simplest way of doing that. It's been, over my 25 years, it's been pretty substantial. As you say, they were already reasonably efficient animals as they were. Mm. But it's really been this drive for, a drive for leanness helps with the efficiency aspects and things like that.
What lessons do you think, you know, the sort of the larger sheep and cattle industry could learn from pork and intensive agriculture?
It's you can get into all kinds of arguments here and get all kinds of interesting feedback. To me, the biggest ones is actually is looking forward. And like, so what's short-term and what's long-term thinking? And some of that I think is associated with the capital that's tied up with pork production and chicken production. So you've got big sheds which are built, and there isn't much use for those outside of being pig production sheds or chicken production sheds. And so it's really thinking about where your market's going to be in the next 5 years, where the community sentiment is going to be in the next 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, and going, okay, well, if we build a shed or we retrofit a shed, then that's got a 15 or 20 year life to it. So we've got to really be thinking about, where's that market going to be? What's that market going to want down the track? And that's where I think what I see some of the differences are is the fact that, why are we still talking about mulesing 20 years after it was raised as an issue by animal rights people? Sometimes it's just worthwhile taking those arguments off the table.
Completely. So get rid of it totally, effectively, is what you're saying, right?
Yeah, because it's always going to be there. And, no matter how well you defend what you can do with it, the, pain relief, et cetera, et cetera, all you need is one bad image and your whole argument's gone down the drain pretty damn quick.
So that's the equivalent would be the use of farrowing crates or tail docking or something in the pig space. And you're saying that, like, that the pig sector is being a bit more proactive in kind of positioning themselves so that they're not going to be
targets.
Create targets or being able to be criticised for practices.
I think it's an approach of going, what are the issues? What are the issues that are going to be in the future? Okay, how do we get ourselves into a position where we can actually address those ones without losing productivity or without losing profitability in those things? And okay, what do we need to do? What are the research gaps missing? How do we fill those in? That kind of aspect. A proactive step to me is always a better step than a reactive one. And from an industry perspective, it's going to have less impact than a reactive response is going to do.
No, fair enough. You mentioned before as well regarding animal, we spoke about animal welfare activists, and you're saying that, I think it was along the lines of that they're frustrating or annoying, but also necessary to a degree. Was that the kind of paraphrasing that you mentioned? Was that, you want to elaborate?
Yeah, and that's sort of my view and my perspective. It's clearly stressful and frustrating to the farmers when we have people breaking into farms, taking footage, unknown. And you see in that footage some of just the operant response of sows. Like, they get fed in the morning, so if you open a shed door and turn on a light, they're waiting to be fed. Mm-hmm. And that's some of the response that you see. And some of the other footage where you see the gestation stalls, or what they're claiming as gestation stalls, and they're a system that's currently known as, what you're seeing is basically what we call mating stalls, which some systems still run, and you'll see a lot of spray mark on their back because that's when sows are being detected in heat and getting ready to mark and things like that. So you've got that aspect. But they're also highlighting what those potential issues are for us. and going, okay, so yeah, what
is
the community
average,
concern?
Well, that's my next question. Do you reckon the average consumer of meat product would be that conscious of these practices? And do you think they pay, as a generalization, you think the average consumer would pay attention to what some of these animal rights groups are promoting?
I think, again, putting my words into other people's, but I think there might be a very short-term impact. But we all know who manufactures Apple phones in China, and yet we all still buy them. So I think, I think the impact, it's often talking to their own bubble, and those groups are often, somewhat advertising to themselves. But I think, we know that price is still the number one driver of decision making in a supermarket. Price and whether your kids will eat it.
Talking about supermarkets, on a bit of a tangent there, I think I've read you say before that you're not concerned about imports of pork. Which is an interesting one, because a lot of people that we speak to in the pork industry always complain about the volume coming in from, say, Northern Europe, and, you know, obviously it's all finished goods, nothing fresh. But how is your view slightly different?
So, I have some personal views on these ones. So just to clarify, we import pig meat into Australia. Has to be, well, sorry, we don't. There's an industry in a processing sector that imports imports pig meat into Australia. And that's got to be deboned, have certain lymph tissues not included, and it has to be further processed into Australia. So that's things like cooked small goods, so your deli hams, your bacons, things that are heavily transformed, and that's part of a disease risk and a profile, and that aspect. Where I see it is, the pig industry, when I first started, went through a really bad period. So we went from 350 sows. So we measure the size of the herd in Australia by sow numbers. So we went from about 350,000 sows down to about 250,000 sows. And that was a reflection of importations of meat and a real response to a change in focus. But since that time, and our focus on domestic fresh meat, which is what the industry is primarily focused on now, then we've had a much greater stability of pricing. We don't get the ebbs and flows. And part of that is due to the fact that we're not servicing a processing industry which has quite different requirements for different cuts. So your middle bacon, for instance, comes off a 75, 80 kilo carcass, whereas your hams for the big processed deli hams and things like that, so the big processed boneless deli hams comes off a much larger animal. So you always had those leftover parts which needed to find a place in the market.
Like black pudding.
Black pudding.
Well, and that was the thing. They went into products that was low value meats. And it was probably high value meat that happened to go into these low value meats. So now that the industry is basically domestically focused, then it's a lot more stable. Supply and demand is pretty well matched. We have our moments, and when we get to the stage where supply gets over a little bit of demand, and we get concerns there. But since that import market has existed, then stability in pricing has improved greatly.
Do you think, because from an export perspective, though, if you contrast the Australian pig sector to cattle or sheep, and cattle's been heavily export focused in terms of where the production goes for many decades. The sheep sector, I guess you could say, in the last 20 years has been significant expansion in or proportion of export focus away from domestic. But whereas the Australian pig industry, there's a small proportion that gets exported to a handful of countries, but it's nothing like...
Singapore would be pretty much...
It's high. Singapore, I think the Philippines take a bit, in Vietnam a little bit as well increasingly. But it's not big, right? Not in terms of overall Australian production, what's eaten domestically versus what goes export. And obviously we have a lot that come in as an import. Do you think as a sector, should the sector be focused towards trying to grow that export side of the game as well, or not really?
Personal opinion, I think it's a market, and there are much bigger players in that market than what we are that have a much lower cost.
Cost of
production. Like our grain prices here relative to the rest of the world are quite scary at times.
So it's the grain farmers that are holding back the pork sector is what you're saying between the lines.
Absolutely.
Maybe we should get like a donation drive from the grain growers in like the good years, you know, just hold a bit back on price for the struggling pork industry.
Yeah, that hasn't been very successful.
No, because that was one of the things I remember in the last drought, because we haven't really had a drought since 2018, 2019. Yeah. And I know like we consulted quite a bit to a couple of different pork companies back then.
Mm.
And that was one of the concerns, was that it was so hard to import grains, or whether it's sort of grains, whole grains, or whether it was sort of, you know, distillers grains or soybean meal or whatever else. But it was hard to import versus anywhere else in the world, which was a competitive disadvantage for pork producers and also chicken producers as well. But basically any consumers that consume grain, it's difficult getting it into Australia. Like we've got, you know, stringent biosecurity reasons. It's protocols for a reason, but it does make it difficult to compete if all your other competing countries can import sort of willy-nilly. Like in the UK, it's not, you can import pretty much from anywhere and anything you want without really much in the way of biosecurity protocols.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, and the contrast is we have our own biosecurity protocols to stop importation of pork.
Yeah.
Into this country. So yeah, I don't think it's an argument that we're ever going to really raise, because the potential for it to biting us in the ass is quite high. So, but it is, and it's bringing grain in from Western Australia into Queensland.
Well, here's a question for you. If they allowed the import of fresh pork meat into Australia from, say, the US or Brazil or anywhere, would there be a pork industry in Australia?
I think it would be, well, let's take New Zealand as an example.
Yeah,
the company I work for now has more sows than the whole of New Zealand does. So the New Zealand pork industry is shrinking. There's some other reasons as well, but a lot of that is driven by importation of fresh meat. When you can land pork cuts into Australia per kilo, the same price as what we can produce them for. The pork industry would struggle with importation of fresh meat. It's as simple as that.
It's a meat commodity too. That's like, I mean, this is true of lots of meat commodities, but you do have segmentation within the beef space where you've got particular branded products or, you know, products that can attract an additional price premium because of a reason, you know, whether it's a Wagyu type genetic or whether it's a, you know, Angus or some other, you know, grain fed something or branded something. And the sheep industry is moving towards that. They're not quite there either yet. But for pork and chicken, it pretty much is a commoditized, what's the price? There's not, I mean, you can call free range pork is one aspect, I guess, or free range chicken. But outside of that, there's not a lot more kind of specific
differentiation between.
Yeah.
No. The premium pork products are your value added products.
Yeah. Mm.
And like, it's a reflection. You go into a restaurant, you'll get a pork belly as an entree. And yeah, if you're lucky, you'll have a chef that can't ruin a pork cutlet.
But it's very, it is a
outside of that,
it's rare to see pork in any restaurant, apart from Asian restaurants.
Well, yeah,
but it's pretty rare to see pork on a menu these days.
Yeah, as a main menu item, it's yeah, and normally those restaurants will have some connection. They're in a processing town, or they're in something like that. But yeah, that premium market is quite difficult. And like, yeah, pork ribs were really big for a while.
Hmm. They seem to have gone. You don't see them in restaurants anymore.
Yeah, and part of that, I think, is the quality. So they were able to start importing pork ribs via New Zealand in retort packaging.
Hmm.
So that's your packaging where it's cooked overseas in those foil containers, sauces and everything, and then yeah, you can reheat them in the oven kind of thing. And it was a way around those restrictions on those, and that basically decimated the price for fresh domestic pork ribs.
Yeah.
Those pork rib imports would have had a bone in them though, wouldn't they?
Yeah, but they're cooked.
Yeah. They're cooked already, so they're okay. Okay. Not fresh. Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. They taste like crap and rubbery as all hell. But yeah.
I've had it before, the ones from the supermarket, and it's grey, would be how I describe it. And sort of it doesn't fall off the bone in the same way that when you get fresh ribs where it's nice, and it's just too gloopy in a way.
Yeah. And there are some rib products made from Australian products that are really quite handy and have quite success in the supermarkets. But yeah, it's really into that food service space where you don't see it until it's actually on your plate in front of you, covered in a rich red sauce.
Yeah.
And yeah, rich red sauces can hide a lot of sins.
Yep, that's true. That's true.
You mentioned, like, and I brought up the live export factor in the Sixth Sense, but I kind of added, I combined together cattle and the sheep side. But not that long ago, Andrew put up it was actually quite a popular tweet, wasn't it? The one you asked about unpopular opinions in agriculture or something. And then I noted that you came along, Robert, on your Meat Evangelist Twitter handle and said that your unpopular opinion was we should just get rid of the live. I think you were specifically referring to the live sheep trade and saying we should just bite the bullet and close it down. Do you want to elaborate? And you mentioned it was about management of risk again, I guess, like what you've been saying before around mulesing or other kind of practices. What's your view there, Rand? Because obviously you copped a little bit of backwards and forwards from the sector and quite a few West Australians. Do you want to have an opportunity to kind of flesh your idea out and explain?
Oh, it's sometimes it's poking the bear, but yeah, it's like you look at the actual value of, well, apart from this season where it's rebounded up, the export market for live sheep was in freefall. It was almost halving every year, kind of thing, and the value of it was going down. And yeah, you look at the value of that industry specifically versus the value of the rest of the sheep meat industry. And you look at some of the campaigns overseas around mulesing and wool, where you've got, yeah, you've got campaigns against Australian wool because of mulesing in New York and in Italy and places like that, which are threatening industries. And it's really, if that targeted campaign becomes more widespread, and it seems to be, there's a lot more in the media around it now, is that a threat to countries potentially boycotting lamb imports, boxed lamb imports and various other things like that? And if you just look at the dollar value or the dollar numbers between, and okay, that dollar value is very important for West Australian farmers.
Yeah.
But But if you look at an industry overall, it's like 1.5-2% of the value of the industry. And the potential impact and the potential risk for the rest of the industry could be quite large. So my sort of thoughts, if I'm a West Australian sheep producer, is going across to eastern state sheep producers and going, well, why can't we find an alternative industry? Why can't you fund me to help find an alternative industry to reduce the risk for you guys?
That's a good point.
Which I guess part of what, you know, hopefully the government in their current format looking at phasing it out. There's been no announcement yet around the delivery of that particular report or what the plan is. But obviously it's on the agenda, and the big question is how do they go about it? What's the timeline? And exactly what you're saying, particularly from the West Australian perspective. If they are going to do that, what are they going to put in place to help facilitate it so it doesn't cause, you know, excessive damage?
Yeah, and that's sort of where my perspective of where's your thinking about where are you thinking about your position of your industry? Are you looking next season, or are you looking 10 years time or 15 years time? But yeah. The live export being a welfare issue, and okay, whether it is or whether it isn't, but a perceived welfare issue, has been pretty active for 20 years. And I sort of look and go, okay, so where's the alternative for these sheep? What's been done? Like, over 20 years, you should really expect that, or I would expect that someone's looking at an alternative system for these kinds of things. Because at some stage, there's a potential for it to stop overnight. All you need is another Israeli animal rights group putting a court injunction, and we know that can do potentially for getting a license to export things. Mm.
Well, I just sent a message to Andrew last night watching the SBS news, and they finally started discussing the potential prospect of a minority Labor government in power at the next election, which is the first time I've heard it openly discussed on the news to that degree. And it's something Andrew and I had spoken about when probably was last year or even earlier, wasn't it, Andrew? We've spoken a few times about the risk, particularly for live export of sheep and the timeline that the industry is looking at potentially. If Labor end up having to cobble together a minority government with the Greens, which would be the most likely other group, that could drastically change the timeline at which the live sheep trade, and maybe even puts live cattle on the agenda as well, more specifically.
I think there's lots of left-leaning, in inverted commas, people that are disappointed in this current Labor government, that they actually haven't delivered on what they could have. Hmm. They're being seen as liberal light. I've got a daughter that's coming up to voting age, and her group is either split to the LNP or they're split to the Greens. The Labor Party is becoming an interesting wedge in the middle of being neither here nor there. So just how we've had the Liberal Party minority governments with Nats as a member, then we're likely to, I think in the future, we're very likely to have a Labor minority government with the Greens as their partner.
And that's what the issue becomes for animal welfare when it gets guided from from a different point of view, from the sort of the central view of a combination of animal welfare being high, but also economic prosperity.
It's not a mainstream animal welfare aspect. It's a fringe animal welfare aspect that starts to drive the agenda.
But I think it'd be very hard to see a Liberal government coming in what, 2 years' time? Less than 2 years' time? Next year? Next year, yeah.
2025.
Yeah, it is. I suspect we might even go down. Like, you look at a country like Germany, who for several years now has had to form some form of conglomerate of a, there's not one party that's been able to get absolute power to run in its own right. So they've had to have, you know, some kind of horse trading between parties to get the numbers to form government in minority.
There won't be any horse trading in a new government, because that would be against the
animal rights.
Right.
No, but I think it's a significant risk, and it could pose a big change to the potential timeline. But that's for the, like I said, for the live sheep. So where do you sit, Robert, on the, like, does your view around just, you know, hastening down that pathway of just, you know, adjusting the industry away from live sheep in WA, because it's pretty much already happened in the east. So that's what you think for live sheep. What do you think that it should also, because we've seen just recently, and it wasn't to do with the live export side of the agenda, but there was that shipment to Indonesia with the botulism outbreak, which wasn't a good look, but it wasn't necessarily live export relevant to, you know, it was on a ship, but it wasn't, you know, it sounded like the outbreak was, you know, to do with the feed and prior to the loading, and it wasn't kind of a live export specific matter. But it still didn't look good. And obviously that's, you know, there's from time to time we've had issues, not so much in Australia, but there was that live shipment from New Zealand that where the boat sank tragically a few years back, which kind of cast a different perception in New Zealand for the live cattle trade as well. What's your view there with regards to Australia? Because the Australian live cattle trade contributes a bit more to the cattle sector than the live sheep does to the sheep sector. Do you have a different view, or do you think that's equally too risky and affair to kind of continue long term?
I think part of the difference is the length of the journey, and the length of time that something can go wrong. I do think that's one. So yeah, I think if live sheep export ceases, then cattle going to the Middle East isn't going to be viable.
Yeah.
So I think that will cease at the same time.
There's not in the overall scheme of things, though. There's not. I mean, the live cattle to the Middle East, you know, it's not the huge flows. The big flows are clearly, you know, Indonesia, Vietnam, China.
I think one of the saving graces of the live cattle industry is the soft diplomacy that it allows us with Indonesia, and the fact that it's a large value add for
the Indonesians.
And I think that's one of the ones there. To me, one of the major differences is time, and that ability to react, and that ability, or that length of time where things can go wrong. But I think, again, it's going to come under big pressure. Anything that's going to involve the shipping of a live animal with something, the chance of something going wrong is quite small, but when it does, it can go quite wrong in a big way. I think there's going to be a lot of societal pressure on those things to stop. And when you look at the seasonal effect in the north, then that's where I think there's a real big risk to that industry in the north on how do you handle those lighter feeder cattle in a wet season. And again, it's like, okay, so what's the 20-year plan? That's what I sort of see in having worked with a few of the tamer animal welfare groups, if we want to call them that, or the less responsive ones. Then a lot of the work that they want to see is a recognition of where you are now and what your plan for the future is.
Just some of those more moderate animal, you know, because at the end of the day, you know, a focus on welfare is a focus that the producer has as well, right? For obvious reasons. You're not, you know, any sane producer understands the value of having proper welfare, you know, on farm and on, yeah. But some of those groups too, those more moderate ones, they don't have the negativity to it, because one of the ones that they also rail against is intensive farming, right? Obviously, you know, with the cage eggs or the, you know, chickens not being allowed to, you know, behave in their natural manner, like get predated by hawks or something. You know, so insane for the pig side, they say that, you know, in an intensive sector that's not free range for pigs, that they're not able to go and do what they'd normally do as a natural pig. Do you think that's a risk there for that intensive side if we continue to kind of try and adjust and pander to these interests?
I don't think it's an adjusting and pandering to those interests. I think it's actually adjusting to society and the fact that agriculture has to exist in our society, because that's where our consumers and that's where our purchases are.
Mm.
The very extreme groups to me are talking to they're very close, or they're very close people within themselves. Mm. And they just want a blanket stop. They don't want animal production to exist at all.
Or pets, for that matter. Some of the extreme groups, they don't want you to have pets.
Yeah. But there are other groups where there's a realization that, yeah, we need to feed people. People are going to continue eating meat. But how do we improve on some of the things that probably need to be improved on?
Mm. You're talking about... As a consumer group, there's that, what they call the movable middle or whatever, that, you know, don't have that hardcore agenda. They care about welfare and they care about these factors, but they also care about what it costs them to get, you know, affordable meat protein. And that goes back to that earlier question I asked, and that's what I kind of termed the average punter or the average consumer, that movable middle. I'm not as convinced that. You know, if you ask them in a survey outside the shop, do you care about these factors? They go, yeah, absolutely. Do you buy cage eggs? No. And then when they walk out of the shop, they've bought the cheapest cage eggs in their actual trolley. So I wonder how much of what is said from that group and how much they actually act. Do what they say actually match their purchasing decisions, is what I'm querying? Because I'm not convinced that it does necessarily for the average, you know, consumer.
No, I don't. And eggs versus meat is quite an interesting look, because the fact that you've got people that are concerned about egg production that will continue to eat eggs because you're not actually eating the animal per se. Mm. Whereas I think a differentiation. We've got supermarkets now that aren't retailing caged eggs, but there's a ready movement across to free range product. To do that in the pig industry, there's simply not enough free range, and there's not enough land, and there's not enough suitable land to actually move those things across. So I think meat's a bit different because of that consumer difference between eating a product of an animal versus an animal itself. There's still other factors which are considerably higher on the hierarchy of needs when it comes to meat consumption than necessarily how it's produced. And part of that is probably a lack of understanding of how it's produced as well.
Do you know what's just on that free-range pork versus intensive sector type pork? Is there a big change to efficiencies from one sector to the other in terms of feed efficiencies, and that if you allow the pigs to, do you know, the data behind that?
There's a little bit. Most of those free ranges are still raised on straws, as you guys would know.
Yep.
And so they're consuming, we did work on this, they're consuming somewhere between 5 to 7% of their diet as straw, which is obviously having a diluting effect on their diet through that system. So you've got a little bit there. And then your reproductive numbers can often be a little bit lower on those outdoor herds just because of environmental conditions, predation, those kinds of things. But good herds are operating as well as intensive herds would be. But yeah, you're probably going to, if you've got a higher maintenance requirement from that sow to main temperature and on those kinds of things. So efficiency wise is going to be raised a little bit. But probably not massively enough to really make a big difference.
Hmm. Wow, that's interesting. But we've probably come up to the end of the time for this podcast.
Yep.
I had a few other questions, but I think we'll probably keep them for a future podcast, Robert, if you're keen. I was keen for your views, some of your other controversial views. One of those was that crocs are a biosecurity hazard.
No. But crocs are a biosecurity tool.
Tool.
They are, they're very, we have them on quite a lot of our farms in the fact that, yeah, so.
Because they're easy to wash and.
Well, no, so your outdoor boots, so your street clothes or your street boots stay outside of sheds. And then the crocs are the transition footwear whilst you're in the office or whilst you're showering in or showering through. And then, you transfer into your farm boots on the other side. So yeah, we have
officially recognized by Sunpork as the footwear of choice.
Oh.
So we'll have to get the rest of the industry to follow suit.
I think there's quite a few players that that look at Crocs or Croc derivatives, cheaper versions, as being used in that situation.
There you go.
So
they're not just fashionable.
No, also highly practical, an efficiency tool, if you want a better descriptor. The only other
that explains a lot because crocs have been around for 20 years and pig production has gone up and productivity has gone up strongly in 20 years.
So it's probably highly correlated.
Yeah.
The only other very controversial thing we didn't touch on that Robert mentioned at the outset was his dislike for black pudding.
But you've not actually tried it, have you?
Not for a long time.
Yeah, well, that's the problem. That's where we need to sort of get you another taster of it.
And, he might have had one of those non-pork-based pudding items. There's an Irish one with beef blood that's used. It's not as nowhere near as tasty as the Pacton Park.
That's obviously the premier one to try, the Pacton Park.
Yes.
Available from all small retailers and online. So.
Yes. I also hold the controversial view that I dislike pork belly with a passion as well.
Oh, gosh.
It's hit or miss for me. But before we get you in more trouble for bagging almost every pork product, we're going to leave it there. Robert, it's actually, I really enjoy getting someone on who I've spoken to a lot and we've communicated a lot online and actually putting a face to the name.
Yep.
And I always enjoy your debates with people. I think regardless of whether people agree with your view, you always put forward a pretty strong argument and a level-headed argument.
Well, yeah, when it's a view that's backed in data and science, you've got at least kind of look at it and listen and consider, you can always still argue the point and disagree, but as long as it's more than a view that, that you're disagreeing with, not just someone's made up reasonings. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. That's good. Well, thanks very much for coming along.
And Matt, not a problem. And I'm sure there'll be plenty more contrary views I put out there.
Exactly.
Meat of
fun sometimes.
Yeah, Meat Evangelist was the Twitter handle. If you're on Twitter and you missed it, thanks
meat,
for
meat underscore
underscore evangelist. Yeah, you out.
Yes.
So we'll talk about the evangelizing and the religious side of things on the next podcast. There you go. See you when you got nothing on, Robert.
Chuffing out.